Today, Donald Trump, the death penalty, and its relationship with America's racist past. This week, Donald Trump sanctioned the execution of the only woman on federal death row, Lisa Montgomery. She became the 11th prisoner to die since the president restarted federal executions in July, after almost two decades. It's a shift in policy that Guardian US's Ed Pilkington has been reporting on.
That's more than any president has presided over in terms of federal execution throughout the 20th century and the 21st century. So you have to go back to the 19th century to find a killing spree as intense as the one we've just had under Donald Trump.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does it tell us about America that Donald Trump has used the final months of his presidency to execute so many federal prisoners? Before we start, I want to warn you that this podcast contains descriptions of sexual violence and killing that some listeners might find disturbing. Federal executions have started back up again under the Trump administration. Tell me what's going on.
Well, Trump and his previous Attorney General, Bill Barr, they've essentially gone on an enormous, unprecedented and baffling killing spree right in the dying days of his administration. There have been several executions in the lame duck period after he lost the presidential election, which hasn't been done for more than 100 years. Everything about what he's doing and the administration is doing is exceptional, extraordinary, and it goes completely against the grain of the direction in which America had been moving. I mean, it's not just that these federal executions are the first time that the US government itself has been killing prisoners for 17 years. It's in opposition to the way that the country is moving at state level, where most executions happen. States have been quietly dropping executions entirely, abolishing the death penalty. Colorado abolished it in 2020, becoming the 22nd state to do so. And if you can't add to that the number of states that haven't killed anyone in for more than 10 years, it's 34. So more than half the country doesn't do executions at all anymore.
And obviously you're talking about what Trump is doing and what the states have been doing. What is the difference between a state execution and federal death row?
You know, essentially, most criminal justice aspects in America are left to states. It's one of the ways that the federal system devolves power in this country. You know, it's important to realize that most death penalty activity happens at state level and always has done. Let's look at the number of prisoners on death rows around the country. In total, there are about 2,500 of them, of which only 52 are in federal death row, the federal death row, which is mainly at Terre Haute prison in Indiana. So it's an enormous disparity. The federal government really hasn't engaged in the death penalty much at all in modern times. And yet, here we have it for the first time ever in US history. The federal government has executed in 2020 more prisoners than all the states combined, a completely unprecedented and entirely baffling event, which has, you know, caused a lot of discussion and debate.
Daniel Lewis Lee received a lethal injection in Indiana after the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the
execution. Can you tell me about the first federal execution that took place last year? Who was it?
So the first execution we had by the U.S. government was Daniel Lee. It happened in July. If you look at any of these cases, they all have really hideous, horrifying crimes, murders at the center of them. Some of the details are very disturbing. So we're not talking about, in many cases, we're not even talking about innocence. We're talking about horrifying crimes that were committed and what should be done with the perpetrators. Now, in the case of Daniel Lee, a family of three were killed. The group of people that Lee was in that killed the family of three, one of them was an eight-year-old girl, and yet Lee actually tried to stop the girl being killed. He refused to kill that child and tried to stop the others in his group from doing it. And yet he is being held responsible for that death and he's being executed while other members of the group have been put into life sentences without parole. The family of the victims of Lee and his co-defendants have strenuously and over many years opposed the execution of Lee. They've tried to stop it. They pleaded with the federal government not to go ahead and do it, and they weren't listened to, which again is interesting because Barr and Trump have repeatedly said they're doing this for the victims.
And that was only July. How many people have been killed since then?
Well, in the 6 months left in 2020, from July to the end of the year, some 10 federal inmates were executed. When you look at the actual people they selected, it's almost as though they chose the ones super designed to cause most controversy and upset most people. There's Lesmond Mitchell.
Lesmond Mitchell is the only Native American on death row and could become the first Native person in modern American history
executed for the murder of one of his own tribe members. And the murder happened on tribal land, right, which is actually legally run by the Navajo Nation, the government of the Navajo Nation. And the government of the Navajo Nation has for years deposed the death penalty, and it fiercely opposed Mitchell's execution. And yet they went ahead and did it. Then there was Brandon Bernard.
Last night, 40-year-old Brandon Bernard was executed by lethal injection at a federal prison in Indiana. 11th-hour attempts for court intervention.
The youngest teenage defender, he was 18 at the time of the murder in which he was involved in Texas. He's the youngest teenage offender to have been executed in almost 70 years. He was actually a low-level member of the gang that killed a couple in a carjacking, did not do the shooting. There was another case, Dustin Honken, which was the first case for nearly 60 years, in which a federal prisoner was executed from a state which has abolished the death penalty, and that's Iowa. And the last case I point to is Alfred Bourgeois.
This morning, a Louisiana man has been put to death, the second execution carried out by the federal government. In just 2 days, 56-year-old Alfred Bourgeois was convicted of killing his...
The defense case in his case was that he is actually intellectually disabled. It's supposed to be unconstitutional and therefore unlawful to execute an intellectually disabled prisoner, and yet the federal government went ahead.
And we're now 5 days away from inauguration. Donald Trump has been firmly voted out. And yet there have been further cases this week. As we record, two more executions are due to take place, Corey Johnson and Dustin Higgs. And on Wednesday, Lisa Montgomery, a very high-profile case, was killed by lethal injection.
She's the first woman to be put to death since 1953. Her lawyers and supporters had appealed to President Trump for clemency.
Tell me about her.
As someone who has written about umpteen death penalty cases, this one truly set me back. It's a very, very shocking case. And even the lawyers I spoke to who have dealt with many more cases than I have said they'd never seen anything like it. They've never seen a woman in particular, which is pertinent to this case, but a prisoner of any nature, who has been so tortured, and that's their word, torture, who's so tortured and traumatized in their childhood and upbringing, and with such glaring and obvious mental illness that they were facing execution, that they were selected for execution. They've never had a decision like that to have to deal with. And they were astounded that the Trump administration even decided to choose her as one of the cases they wanted to pull out and put in the death chamber. Trigger warning here, the crime she committed, and there's no doubt about innocence or guilt here, she confessed to it. The crime she committed is beyond comprehension. She murdered a woman who she befriended online and cut out her 8-month-old baby from her womb because she wanted to have that baby for herself. And she then spent several hours passing off the baby as her own before she was arrested. In her trial, she was convicted, and then the key question was, should she get executed or should she be given life without parole? There was never any question that she was ever going to see the light of day out of prison. It was more a question of should she die or not. And in the original trial, the jury did not hear much about her background, and that's kind of the second part of the story. Trigger warning again, when you look into her background, it's almost as horrifying as the crime she committed. Her mother abused her from a young age. She was indirectly subjected to sexual abuse from the age of 3. From the age of 11, she was directly raped on a regular basis by her stepfather. She was also subjected to gang rapes organized by her parents.
Oh, my God. So upsetting.
As a result of that, she developed clear mental illness, and multiple people I spoke to were without a shadow of doubt on that point. It's interesting, one of the lawyers looked into that case and found out that there were 16 other women around America who committed similar crimes, and yet none of the other 16 were on death row. In each case, they were given life sentences. And the thinking behind that was partly because they, to do something like that, to try and rip a fetus from a living woman's womb, is palpably a form of mental illness. It's hard to see it in any other form. And so they got incredibly harsh sentences. And as I say, most of them will never see the light of day outside prison. But none of them have gone to death row. Only this one woman, Lisa Montgomery.
Who's making these decisions? Is it Donald Trump himself who picks out who's going to be executed?
To be fair to Donald Trump, I don't think he would go down to that level. For most of these cases, Bill Barr was Attorney General, which means he was the chief prosecutor in America in July when the decision was announced. And it would have been the Justice Department that made the decision on which specific prisoners were pulled out. But bear in mind, it was Trump that set the parameters of this policy during his campaigning. He said he was in favor of restarting the death penalty.
I've always supported the death penalty. I don't even understand people that don't.
And why? Why is Trump reintroducing all these executions?
The timing of it is very, very disturbing. They started in July, at which point the polls were already indicating that Donald Trump was in trouble. Joe Biden was doing very well. It looked like he would have a difficult job getting reelected. So it kind of forces the question, I think, and some commentators have deliberated this point. It raises questions, did he and Barr kind of kickstart the system because they knew they wouldn't be around for much longer, which is a deeply disturbing thought in itself. In a broader sense, I think, you know, understanding what's happening here lies in the understanding of Trump's wider relationship to what's happening in America at the moment, specifically his relationship to his own base of Trump supporters and the foment which has been building for years and which he himself is now supercharged, as we saw last week with the storming of the Capitol building. The increasing tensions around diversity and race in America, the fact that the white majority is kind of shrinking, that within not so many years, America will become a majority-minority country in the sense that non-white groups will form the majority. And as a result, there's increasing concern and tension around the issue of what power do white Americans have left. I think it's impossible to understand the death penalty in America if you don't see it through the lens of race in any case, because after all, the modern death penalty in America came out of America's disturbed racial history.
Tell me how it all links back to that.
One way of understanding is to think about an individual, Brian Stevenson. He lives in Montgomery, Alabama. He's one of the foremost death penalty lawyers in the country, and that's where he began. He began by defending largely African-American men on death row who were, you know, among the forgotten of the forgotten. No one was representing these people, and they had virtually no chance of surviving the rush to execute them that was happening largely in the southern states like Alabama. And he got so immersed in cases, several of which he actually led to exonerations. He actually proved that the men were innocent and got them off death row, and in several cases actually released from prison entirely. But by looking into that, he started wondering, where did this all come from? And his journey, which is extraordinary and very powerful, took him back to slavery and what happened post-slavery. Now, post-slavery, the challenge for the Southern Confederate states was, how do you control all these freed black people who live among you in your Southern communities? How do you do that if slavery no longer exists and they are legally free? We obviously know many of the answers to that. You prevent them from voting, which is a battle that continues to this very day. And then the Ku Klux Klan was formed and they started lynching black men. often for claims of sexual nature, that they'd had sexual relations with white women, often without any evidence at all. But it was designed as a form of racial terror that was inflicted right across the Confederate states and even in other parts of America, including the North and California and other places. And Bryan Stevenson became so immersed in this, he set up the first national memorial to lynching, to the racial lynching of black people in America, which opened just a few years ago in Montgomery, Alabama. Bryan Stevenson then takes us from lynching to the modern era where it's no longer acceptable to lynch people. You can't get away with it. It's not going to be allowed. The civil rights movement happened. Black people rose up and stopped it happening. The federal government had to act. And out of that came another vortex. Well, what do you do if there's no lynching? How do you spread terror among black communities in the former Confederate states? Bryan Stevenson's thesis, which I think is very persuasive, is that the death penalty became what he calls the stepson of lynching.
And yet in this country, in the states of the old South, we execute people. We are 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white than if the victim is black, 22 times more likely to get it if the defendant is black and the victim is white. In the very states where there are buried in the ground the bodies of people who were lynched, and yet there is this disconnect.
And it's interesting, if you look back to the early 20th century, when a lot of all this was happening, 9 out of 10 executions involved black prisoners, and most of them were for the rape of a white woman. And that's exactly the same territory as lynching. It's exactly, you know, the tool of racial terror that was imposed in an attempt to keep black communities down post-slavery.
And it's obviously not as explicit as it once was. These are not people who are dressing up in their Ku Klux Klan outfits and lynching people. What are the processes now?
The story of the transition from the age of lynching, where more than 4,000 black people were lynched across the country up to 1950, the transition from that into a system of modern death penalty is one in which the sort of anger and the hostility of the Ku Klux Klan became embedded in systemic patterns of legal procedure, of which certain things kind of leap out at you. Well, first off, that the death penalty is receding in America. It's shrinking. It's becoming less and less common. But where it still exists is increasingly the Confederate states, or the states of the former Confederacy in the South. It's very, very common that black people on death row will have been given capital sentences by juries that are either all white or largely white. And when lawyers have looked into how that happened, you find that the number of black jurors that are struck off before they sit on a jury without any explanation given is hugely more. It's like 5 times more than white jurors who are struck off. So there's a history of prosecutors actively kind of eradicating black people from juries, which the Supreme Court has tried to kind of push back against, but it's been a difficult road and you know, it's still a prevalent problem, I think, in a lot of these cases. The emphasis on white victims and black perpetrators, that still exists. And I think that's a systemic thing, and it kind of governs the way prosecutors make the decision of whether or not to proceed with cases as capital cases. It begins with the prosecutor. They decide whether to pursue the case as a capital case or not.
And we all know that there have been miscarriages of justice. We see exonerations. We know innocent people end up on death row. And some must have been killed for crimes they did not commit. Do these disparities, these racial disparities you're talking about, show up in these figures as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are many different reasons why you could make an argument for abolishing the death penalty in America. But the single overriding, most powerful and most important is innocence, that people have gone to their deaths at the hands of the state who are innocent. And how do we know that? Well, the main thing is we know that there have been 173 exonerations between the 1970s and the current moment. So, you know, think about that alone. I mean, there were 173 people, of whom most of them were black, kind of about a third were white, and several were Latino. So very large proportion were black and other minority groups. 173 people who would have died had they not had the assiduous work of defense lawyers coming to their assistance and saving them. Even more chilling, there are cases that have been reported out where almost certainly the innocent person did go to their death. And I think that's the overwhelming, most powerful case against it. As change happens, it's going to be one of the big drivers of change in America.
And that shift you're talking about, that shift has happened in recent years because, as you told us, Trump's decision to restart federal executions meant that people were being killed for the first time in 17 years in federal cases. If we just go back in time, before Obama, who clearly didn't execute anyone, have presidents tended to take a similar stance on this issue?
It's never been particularly on the radar of presidents. It's not been an important issue for them. From 1972, as with all death penalty cases in America, the practice was stopped. For the first and only time in American history, the US Supreme Court put a stop to it. Interestingly enough, because they said it was too uncertain. There was not enough consistency about who was chosen to be executed and who actually was put to death. And they particularly singled out the fact that more black people than white people were being executed. So that really cuts to the center of this huge theme behind the death penalty here. When the Supreme Court allowed the death penalty to restart 4 years later, states gradually started resuming it, particularly in the South, in the former Confederate states. The federal government really didn't touch it. They decided just not to go back to it. I don't think it was a priority, so they just didn't do it. It was not until the 90s that the federal government got interested again, I think for two, again, suggestive reasons. The first was the war on drugs. If you recall, the 90s was a time when there was a lot of concern about crack cocaine, about rising homicides, very heavily racially tinted debate. A lot of the discussion was about majority African-American neighborhoods of the inner cities. It was from out of that that we got the era of mass incarceration, as Bill Clinton's highly controversial 1994 crime bill, which is seen as the start of mass incarceration and huge numbers of young black males being put in prison. The other big driver was terrorism. There's Oklahoma City bombing carried out by a white supremacist in 1995, a huge shock to the system. At least 168 people died in that bombing of a federal building. And I think the nation was so shocked, the federal government decided it needed to get back in the game, and it did so. And there were only three executions in the early 2000s, the first of whom was Timothy McVeigh.
This morning, the United States of America carried out the severest sentence for the gravest of crimes. The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing have been given not vengeance, but justice.
It's only from July that it just goes ballistic with Trump completely and his administration going for it suddenly out of nowhere.
Did we know when Trump took over in 2016 what his views were over the death penalty?
Yeah, they're snippets, but there are things that he alluded to. I mean, if you go right back, I think it's very important to position this with his notorious full-page ad that he took out over the Central Park Five, the black youths who were accused of raping a woman in Central Park, who turned out to be innocent and have been fully exonerated over the years. Now, he took out an ad saying that he thought that New York State should revive the death penalty in order to deal with the Central Park Five. And in 2018, so he's now president, he gave us another insight. He was responding to the terrible opioid epidemic that's happened across the country, which, you know, a large proportion of those who've died in the opioid epidemic have been white. I think that's part of the story. But he called for the death penalty to be specifically applied to drug traffickers involved in causing that opioid crisis.
Okay, so we've talked about this idea that Trump has favoured the death penalty, but it's not been a campaigning issue for him. more a last-minute attempt to appeal to his base. But it also feels darker than that. When I think about the images from the Capitol last week, the type of people who were there among his base, Proud Boy members, walking through the corridors, actually carrying the Confederate flag, doesn't it really link back to what you were telling me earlier, to America's racial history and to Donald Trump's relationship with the far right?
Absolutely. The image that I get stuck in my brain that connects those two things was that reporters who were on Capitol Hill last week and who actually in the middle of this insurrection, they heard rioters chanting about Vice President Mike Pence. You remember Pence at that point had already indicated that he was not going to sort of unconstitutionally overthrow the results of the election and throw out the will of millions of American voters in order to allow Trump to steal the election, which is what we're talking about. Trump was very cross with him and had been speaking out against him. And a number of the rioters were reported to be saying about Mike Pence, the vice president of America, Donald Trump's number two, that he should be, one, he should be lynched, two, he should be executed. And kind of there you have it. It's like the language is still there, the symbolism is there, the hatred is there, the violence is still there, and it's all about lynching and execution. You know, maybe on a slightly more positive note, and I think that, again, there's an echo here with what happened last Wednesday at the Capitol building. That was so, so shocking that it has forced a reckoning, a force of rethinking. And I think the same is happening with this killing spree that Trump and his cohorts have embarked upon. It has brought back the debate about the death penalty, which was actually wasn't happening very much because at state level, it's been so on the decline in recent years. And so it's kind of forced the issue back to the top of the agenda and people having to confront it again. And again, we don't know what that's going to lead to, but it could potentially lead to some positive change.
Coming up, what happens in 5 days' time when Joe Biden takes over? Ed, we're nearly at the end of the Trump presidency, and he is about to be replaced by President-elect Joe Biden. Before running for office, what do we know about his views on this subject?
When Biden was running in the Democratic primaries last year, he got into quite a lot of difficulty with the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party over his track record on criminal justice. Notably, that 1994 crime bill that Bill Clinton signed, that kind of is seen as the start of the era of mass incarceration, and the same bill that restarted the federal death penalty. Well, Joe Biden has claimed that bill for his own, and indeed he was the lead author of it. So he's had to answer himself, and initially he tried to defend it, but kind of more recently, in all but name, he's been trying to sort of walk away from what he did in that bill. He talks about wanting to eliminate the federal death penalty. He's clearly taking a much more progressive line. I think what that means is we can certainly expect no more federal executions to take place. He's under pressure from a number of Democrats to go further than that and actually take all the 52 inmates off federal death row and put them back onto life sentences. So there's no chance of starting up the federal executions once again, because there won't be anyone on death row in the federal system anymore.
So it's pretty clear that Joe Biden has taken a very different turn now that he's about to become president. We know that his vice president-elect, Kamala Harris, has always opposed the death penalty. We also know that the Democratic Party has been shifting against the death penalty. In fact, in 2016, it formally opposed it in its party platform. You said there won't be any federal executions. Is there anything that Joe Biden can do about state executions?
He's talked about incentivizing states from moving away from the death penalty, but he hasn't stipulated what that means. And in practice, there's not that much he can do to stop the states from carrying on executions should they choose to. And, you know, I think we go back to one of the key statistics in all this is that if you break down overall popular opinion about the death penalty, overall, it's kind of 50-50 now, for and against the death penalty across the general population. But if you ask only Republicans, it rises to about 80% in favor of executions. And with 80% of their voters in largely Republican states in the South sticking with the death penalty, it's going to be, you can see it's going to be a difficult job putting an end to this terrible thing once and for all.
Those figures are obviously incredibly striking, as is the very fact that America is one of the few countries to still use capital punishment. In 2019, it was sixth in the world for having the most executions after China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Egypt. What does it tell us about America as a nation that it still employs the death penalty to that extent?
You know, I think it, and I've always thought that it brings to the surface an integral, absolutely seminal part of this country that normally most people try and, you know, ignore or pretend doesn't exist. You know, the shock that we saw from the storming of the Capitol last week, you know, people responded as though, oh, what? Is this what America's really like? We never knew this was there. And yet in the death penalty, it's been there all the time. It's always been there, and it is a sort of streak of brutality. It's a bit like a sort of vein running down the spine of America, of brutality, of vengeance, of desire for blood. That is all dressed up in legal language. I mean, I've sat through hours of legal argument involving some of the top lawyers in the country discussing the minutiae of how to kill someone. And you sort of pinch yourself and think, how can this be happening in the United States, and supposedly, you know, according to many Americans, you know, a uniquely civilized and democratic country. And it's always been there. And I think if you understand it, you can start to understand a vital part of the country. And last week we saw in Washington, D.C., what happens when that part of the country rises up and says, we will not be ignored.
Ed Pilkington, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Guardian US chief reporter Ed Pilkington, who has been writing about the death penalty in America for many years and who wrote a harrowing profile of Lisa Montgomery earlier this month. You can find his reporting at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Cass Denton and Toby Thomas. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.